U.S. troops still in harm's way in Syria. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. ISIS claims responsibility for a blast that killed U.S. troops in Syria today. Some in Congress worry President Trump's plan to pull out U.S. troops has emboldened the enemy.
My concern by the statements made by President Trump is that you had set in motion enthusiasm by the enemy we're fighting.
Also, the shutdown effect on our already overwhelmed immigration courts.
It means that thousands of cases across the country are being canceled on a daily basis.
And on the Brexit beat, what an open border means to someone in Derry, Northern Ireland.
If I go to walk my dog, I walk my dog in the nearby beach. And that happens to be in the Republic of Ireland.
Brexit might change that. Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're going to begin with news today out of northern Syria, a bomb attack claimed by ISIS that killed U.S. service members. Details are still sketchy, but this is what we know. The U.S. military confirmed that at least two American troops died in an explosion at a restaurant in the town of Manbij. According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, at least 16 people were killed in the blast. Residents in the area said an American helicopter was seen landing to take away wounded U.S. personnel. The World's Matthew Bell has been following the story and is with me in the studio. What do we know, Matthew?
This reportedly happened near a vegetable market, and the CCTV video I was just watching is pretty horrifying. It's broad daylight. It shows people walking on the sidewalk outside of a little restaurant. There's women. There's a little boy there. Suddenly, there's an explosion, a fireball. It sends people fleeing. Witnesses told Reuters that American troops and their local militia partners were on patrol nearby. ISIS was driven out of Manbij, and the town is controlled by Kurdish forces allied with the U.S. Reports said that at least 16 people total were killed in this attack, maybe even as many as 20.
Yeah, it's just awful. It's been a few weeks now since Donald Trump said that ISIS was defeated and U.S. troops in Syria would be coming home soon. Any sense that a deadly attack like this could change the administration's plans for Syria?
Right. That was a little less than a month ago. Donald Trump surprised pretty much everyone with that announcement. As the details of today's attack were being reported, Mike Pence was speaking to a gathering of U.S. ambassadors about U.S. policy in Syria.
We promised under this president's leadership to take the fight to radical Islamic terrorists on our terms, on their soil. The president and I couldn't be more proud. Thanks to the leadership of this commander-in-chief and the courage and sacrifice of our armed forces, we're now actually able to begin to hand off the fight against ISIS in Syria to our coalition partners, and we are bringing our troops home. The caliphate has crumbled, and ISIS has been defeated.
Matthew, there's been a lot of pushback on Trump's decision to pull out of Syria. I mean, it even prompted the departure of the Defense Secretary, James Mattis. What is the latest on this decision?
There's real skepticism in Washington, and that includes among Republicans on Capitol Hill. Today, Lindsey Graham, senator from South Carolina, interrupted a hearing that was about a totally unrelated issue to talk about the attack in Manbij, and he brought up real questions about the president's thinking on Syria.
My concern by the statements made by President Trump is that you had set in motion enthusiasm by the enemy we're fighting. You make people who are trying to help wonder about us. And as they get bolder, the people we're trying to help are going to get more uncertain. I saw this in Iraq, and I'm now seeing it in Syria.
All right. So what is this attack today? Tell us about ISIS and their abilities right now.
Right. I talked with Charles Lister, who's a terrorism expert at the Middle East Institute in Washington, and he said Mike Pence is right. The so-called caliphate on the ground is like 99% taken away from ISIS. But in terms of being a terrorist group with real deadly capabilities, he said ISIS is very far from being defeated.
The Department of Defense is effectively in crisis mode right now, trying to plan a military withdrawal from the country. As I understand it, senior officials within the U.S. government continue to push hard against the idea of an overly hurried withdrawal from Syria. And I think the outcome of this is unclear.
Marco, the Trump administration has said that it is fighting for the quote-unquote enduring defeat of ISIS. Lister said that is likely a long way away, and that the question now for the president is, what does an attack like this mean for the decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria? The top brass at the Pentagon is telling the White House to go slowly, be deliberate, be careful, that this cannot be done without meeting certain conditions first, and that's going to take time.
The World's Matthew Bell telling us about an ISIS attack that killed U.S. troops today in Syria. People in Nairobi, Kenya, woke up to gunshots this morning. The terrorist attack that began yesterday at the Dusit Hotel complex there was finally coming to an end. Al-Shabaab militants have claimed responsibility for this coordinated attack, an attack that killed 14 people. Several dozen other people are still missing. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta says his country is grieving today. Tommy Oladipo is the Africa security correspondent with our partners at the BBC, and today he went to the scene of the attack.
We've been down at the Dusit Hotel complex, which is not far from our bureau here. That means we heard and felt the explosions yesterday. But today it's been a lot more calm. There's been a lot of, when we went there not too long ago, ambulances, fire brigade, lots of police and other security agents. But they seem to be, watching. It appears as if the operation has ended, as the president announced earlier today. But obviously for Kenyans, waking up to the reality that this was not a bad dream, this was actually a case where a lot of blood was shed. And so it's now just finding out who exactly survived and who was lost. And I think that is what Kenyans are coming to terms with today.
Now, the Al-Shabaab connection is something that has worried Kenyans for years. And a day before the attack, so on Monday, three men faced the beginning of a trial for the Al-Shabaab Westgate Mall attack, also in Nairobi. That was in 2013. What's going on with the trial now?
Well, that trial looks like it's going to go ahead. That's 5 years after, more than 5 years after the Westgate attack, and the trial is only sort of just getting on its feet. So it's not clear exactly how long this process is going to take. But some people would say, it's better late justice than none at all. At the same time, when Kenyans look at this kind of incident, then they wonder about the latest attack, and if at all, the perpetrators will be brought to justice soon enough.
Something that's really striking are the campaigns I've been seeing on social media, like Kenyans working together to encourage each other, lift up their spirits, banding together. What are you seeing and hearing from people in Nairobi following the attack?
Yeah, there's been a lot of that. I think Kenyans are especially keen not to cower in fear, especially when these attacks happen. Yes, there is criticism in part of the government, for not being able to prevent this kind of attack. But at the same time, there is that solidarity. We're seeing people saying, we're Kenyans, let's rally together to sort of stand up against these attacks, and that these attacks should not stop people from living their lives and carrying on. So there is that. Obviously, the attackers who Al-Shabaab are claiming to have been, Al-Shabaab, the jihadist group largely based in Somalia, they would want to destabilize the country. They would want to instill fear among Kenyans. But Kenyans sort of fighting back and saying, no, we will stand and not cower in fear.
And as someone who follows this story, I mean, what are you worried about? What are you looking out for, Tommy, right now?
I think the main thing is whether lessons are being learned from these attacks. Westgate happened 5 years ago. If you look at the response then versus the response to yesterday's attack, there were definitely signs that some lessons had been learned in terms of coordination, in terms of the speed of the response, in terms of getting people out, in terms of even just the way the security forces conducted themselves. But if you look at things like intelligence gathering and acting upon intelligence, there are still questions about that. For example, some security analysts suggesting that there was intelligence about this particular attack that was downplayed by the authorities. Mm. So, yes, some lessons have been learned, but there's still some way to go.
Tommy Oladipo is the BBC's Africa security correspondent. During his Senate confirmation hearing, President Donald Trump's nominee for Attorney General William Barr tried to reassure skeptics. He told lawmakers that he would protect the integrity of the Mueller Russia probe, but not everyone was convinced.
I respect him, but I am still very uncomfortable with Mr. Barr, not because of his performance at the hearing, but because of the fact that prior to his nomination, he had sent these unsolicited, I felt somewhat unseemly, opinions to the White House, Department of Justice, and Trump advisors, basically saying his view of undermining the Mueller investigation and having very expansive views of executive power.
That's Senator Mark Warner, the vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He thinks Barr should withdraw his nomination.
If we didn't have a case where we've got in Donald Trump someone who has been literally obsessed about the Mueller investigation, is at every corner tried to undermine it, and now the fact that Mr. Barr, even with his good reputation, had expressed these same concerns that the Mueller investigation, in a sense, could be undermined, is deeply troubling to me. The Mueller investigation is so important. There are so many questions been raised. There's so much that, for example, we have raised on our Senate Intelligence Committee investigation as well that we're not at liberty to disclose at this point. The only way the American public is going to hear the whole truth about what happened and how we make sure this doesn't happen again is if the Mueller investigation is allowed to go on unimpeded. And just the possibility that Barr would undermine that, in my mind, means that he's still got a long way to go before I could ever see to support him.
And in addition to those Barr memos, Senator, yesterday we saw Lindsey Graham, the new chair of the Judiciary Committee, seem to get President Trump's new pick, William Barr, to agree to investigate the people investigating Trump. So there would be a probe of the Mueller probe. Well, what would that mean?
Well, to me, that sounds very similar to the circus that took place in the House over the last 2 years, where the House Intelligence Committee basically investigated the investigators, went out and investigated the FBI, went after people that were involved in the Mueller probe. They came up with zero outcome, and I think that would be candidly a waste of resources. I mean, in the United States of America, where no one is above the law, including the President of the United States, if based on political reasons we start launching investigations of law enforcement when they have independently reached a sense that they need to start an investigation, we're into uncharted territory both legally and in terms of our overall respect for rule of law in this country.
So what do you think? Is a probe of the probe likely to happen?
I would be surprised and disappointed if whomever becomes attorney general would try to launch a probe of the probe. And I mean, this is the first time in my adult lifetime where I've seen such broad-based attacks against the overall integrity of the Department of Justice and the FBI. It's been frankly stunning to me, and being from Virginia, we have a lot of those FBI and Department of Justice professionals who live in our area, and the morale at these agencies because of particularly Mr. Trump's kind of ad hominem attacks is pretty low at this point, and that is a concern to me.
Do you think Barr is signaling anything to Mueller in his comments at these hearings?
Mr. Barr's got a distinguished legal career. But I feel like the whole notion that he sent these memos, these unsolicited memos, which seem to be, in a sense, almost a job application, saying, hey, Donald Trump, don't worry, I'll have your back. I don't think Mueller may be going too far. I think that what we need to maintain is the credibility of the Mueller investigation. And the president should have picked someone that would come with, in a sense, neutral views, or would have come. One of the things that did concern me about Mr. Barr's testimony yesterday was he said if the ethics officers at the Justice Department said he should recuse himself, he didn't agree to that recusal. Again, there's never been an attorney general, to my knowledge, other than the current acting attorney general who went through no clearance or went through no approval process at all, that has said that they could reject the considered ethical opinions from the Justice Department lawyers about a recusal on issues like the Mueller investigation.
Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, is the vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Thanks very much for being with us, Senator.
Thank you so much.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. This might be a first. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi sent a note to President Trump suggesting he postpone his State of the Union address because of the government shutdown. The shutdown is now 26 days in and counting. Some federal employees are being called back to work, like IRS workers who process tax returns, but their paychecks will remain on hold. Meantime, one place where federal employees are not going back to work, the U.S. immigration courts. Saul Gonzalez of KCRW in Santa Monica has that story.
In the lobby of the U.S. Immigration Court building in downtown L.A., there's a notice informing visitors the court is closed because of the government shutdown. And if you miss the notice, the private security guards at the front desk will tell you.
Hey, guys. Immigration courts are all closed? Everything's closed. All right. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
On normal days, this is one of the busiest immigration courts in the country, with over 76,000 cases on its docket annually, many of those cases involving migrants seeking political asylum in the U.S.
And each of the courtrooms are just jam-packed with people.
And today, a ghost town.
Absolutely a ghost town.
Ashley Tabador is an immigration judge assigned to this court, and she's president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. Tabador says the country's understaffed immigration system was already struggling with a crushing backlog of cases, and the government shutdown only makes that worse.
It means that thousands of cases across the country are being canceled on a daily basis. And as you know, we have well over 800,000 pending cases for just a little bit shy of 400 judges. So the impact with every day that's missed becomes much more pronounced when we return and have to address that.
And of course, the shutdown means a longer wait for people who have business before America's immigration courts, including those petitioning for asylum. And there's a chance their cases might even be moved to the back of the wait line when the government does reopen as a way to deal with scheduling gridlock. Outside of the courthouse, people who've come for their scheduled court dates linger after being turned away in the lobby. Vicky Guzman is from El Salvador and has legal status here, but she's trying to get asylum for her teenage daughter because of violence in her native country. They've waited a year for this court date.
Pues yo esperando la corte y la cancelaron.
I'm waiting for the court and they cancel it. But I am hoping for something better for my daughter, so she can study here and do more with her life. I don't want her to suffer the way that I suffered.
Solo le pedimos al presidente que por favor.
We asked the president to please open the court so my daughter and the other parents with family can come to court.
As for Judge Tabador, she notes the irony that a standoff over building a border wall to keep undocumented people out has paralyzed a court system that's essential to deporting people who are unlawfully in the U.S. And like other federal employees, Tabador is worried about the financial bite of the shutdown.
We just missed our first paycheck that we were supposed to have. So obviously now I'm living off of savings. I'm frankly really worried about our support staff. There are, I'm sure, some who are perhaps living paycheck to paycheck, that missing one paycheck is going to have a tremendous impact on them. And so there is this anxiety and stress associated with missing your paycheck and not knowing when the next paycheck is going to be there.
And I guess that puts you as a U.S. immigration judge in the same boat in very fundamental ways as tens of thousands of other employees of the U.S. government.
Absolutely. We are slightly more fortunate because as immigration judges, we do have a higher salary than other employees. But in comparison to our private sector counterparts, we make a fraction of what we our earning potential is. And so, yes, we're all in it together. We're all in this sinking boat together.
For the World, Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
January 16th, 1979 started out as just another day for Iranian Shaul Bakhash. He was working in academia but had recently left journalism. The leader of Iran, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, had made it impossible for reporters to do their jobs. Bakhash had just left his office to grab some lunch when he saw a man in an open Jeep.
Holding aloft a newspaper with huge headlines saying, "The Shah has gone," and there was an explosion of celebration all around me.
That day, 40 years ago, was a turning point. The Iranian Revolution would happen within weeks. Bakhash had been watching since the previous summer as protests against the Shah grew and grew. Bakhash is now professor emeritus of Middle East history at George Mason University. Today I asked him how he felt back then as the Shah left Iran and whether he realized at the time how influential the Muslim clerics were at fomenting protests.
I must say, this is not boasting, but I think I was among the minority who did realize that, because a great many members of the middle class and the intellectual elite thought what they were witnessing was a kind of a revolution to establish democracy. But it was very clear to me watching those huge demonstrations in Tehran where hundreds of thousands of people came out into the streets that the leadership was with the members of the clergy. Mm. You know, I think certainly the growing opposition to the Shah took him by surprise. At least there was an anecdote at the time that he did finally view the demonstrations from a helicopter and was astonished at the size of them. There came a time in Tehran when hundreds of thousands of people were taking part in these protests.
What were you personally concerned about once the Shah left and it was clear that the Ayatollah had come back and was in charge?
Well, you must remember it was a period immediately after the revolution of enormous disorder. You know, things, as it were breaking down. The first prime minister after the revolution, Mehdi Bazargan, described himself as a knife without a blade and talked of Tehran as a city with 1,000 sheriffs.
Shaul, you're an Iranian Jew. Was that also a concern for you?
Well, of course it was a source of concern. I had read Khomeini's tract on Islamic government. It was very clear what his intentions were. What was established was basically a theocracy.
So going back to this day, 40 years ago in 1979, as you said, you were an academic in Tehran, and before that you'd worked as a journalist. Did the people you hung out with, like reporters and Western-trained academics, were they excited about what lay ahead after the departure of the Shah?
Yes, I think they were excited. I think on my old newspaper, the reporters and editorial staff and the printers were universally for the revolution. I was, in a way, surprised that at my university, as I say, just in the process of being established with PhDs from elite universities in the United States, like MIT and Caltech and what have you, all my colleagues were for the revolution. So certainly the enthusiasm for the overthrow of the monarchy was very widespread, although I think people expected many different things from the revolution, each pinning his own or her own aspirations to what they thought the outcome would be, sometimes very wrongly.
Shaul Bakhash, professor emeritus of Middle East history at George Mason University, he's been recalling his memories of 40 years ago today when he lived in Tehran and learned that the Shah and his wife had left the country. Shaul, great to speak with you. Thanks for your time and your thoughts.
My pleasure.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. We're still learning about the first enslaved Africans sold in Virginia 400 years ago.
We have at Jamestown, without any question, a site where one of those first Africans, Angela, lived.
The early roots of slavery in America. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. This just in, Theresa May is still the British Prime Minister. She survived a vote of no confidence in Parliament today. Just yesterday, lawmakers rejected her Brexit plan. Yeah, confusing? Of course it is. It's Brexit. When it comes to Britain's plans to leave the European Union, I think this Londoner speaks for many in the UK right now.
It's absolute chaos, and to be quite honest, I have got no idea what to do next. I honestly haven't. In fact, I've been turning it off. I'm so fed up with it all.
It's been 2+ years of Brexit chaos. The Irish land border is still a huge sticking point. Sinead McLaughlin is on the City Council in Derry, Northern Ireland. That's right on the border between British Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland.
If I go to walk my dog, I walk my dog in the nearby beach. And that happens to be in the Republic of Ireland. So a different jurisdiction, but still part of our hinterland. It's where we go to play and all sorts of things that are just normal everyday activities for normal citizens of a region. And to have it divided in any way would be a very retrograde step back. I mean, I'm of the age that I can remember a hard border in Northern Ireland, and it wasn't pleasant, and it really had a very negative cultural impact on citizens right across Ireland. And to go back to those days would be unfathomable. You know, I couldn't think about it or contemplate that retrograde step. So it really is fundamental, and it's frustrating at how badly negotiated this whole Brexit issue has been from a UK perspective. And, you know, I think it's going to be more of the same for the next few months.
What is the mood like at the Derry City Council meetings these days?
They're concerned. But, you know, in many ways, it's business as usual, because in the absence of knowing where you're going, you can't spend your whole time worrying about it. And you don't want to spend an awful lot of money making plans that may never be needed. And at this stage, with 75 days or 74 days to go before the 29th of March, you know, all of us thought that we would have at least an insight into what the future held and or was going to hold. And we still don't. So it's very regrettable, very frustrating. But the Chinese proverb, may you live in interesting times, yeah, has never been more apt.
Your wishes came true, if that is your wish. So you're in a holding pattern. What are you hopeful for going into the future?
Honestly, from the very outset, I also was vice chair of the Remain campaign for Northern Ireland. And from the very outset, we knew that Northern Ireland had to remain in the customs union and the single market in order to maintain an open border. So going forward, my wish is, if we are to Brexit at all, which is not what I want to do, and it's not good for Northern Ireland in any shape, but if we do, then I would like to remain in the customs union and the single market, thereby not needing a backstop nor not needing any borders within the island of Ireland.
Sinead McLaughlin is a member of Derry City Council in Northern Ireland, giving us her take on Brexit. Sinead, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Another place where Brexit is aggravating long-standing tensions is Scotland. Remember, in 2015, Scotland narrowly voted to remain part of the UK. Then the next year with Brexit, 62% of Scots voted to remain in the EU, while majorities in England and Wales voted the other way. Joanna Cherry represents Southwest Edinburgh in the British Parliament. Her party, the Scottish National Party, is calling for a second Brexit referendum.
That is to say, if Theresa May is as determined to stand by the deal that she's got as it is, if she can't get her deal through the House of Commons, we think she should take it to the people of the United Kingdom so they have a choice between the deal which she has negotiated and the option of remaining.
And what makes you so confident that another referendum would go differently?
Well, I'm confident that the Scots and the Northern Irish will vote for Remain. I am reasonably confident that the English and the Welsh, unlike last time, will choose Remain this time when they look at the facts. Last time, all sorts of promises were made by the Leave campaign that have proved to be undeliverable. Some of us would say that they were actually lies, but let's just call them undeliverable promises. And I think people should be given a chance to vote in possession of the facts. But it's also very important for your listeners to understand that I'm a member of the Scottish National Party. We're the biggest party in Scotland, and our number one policy is an independent Scotland within the European Union. So if this second EU referendum doesn't happen and the Scots don't get a chance to vote again on staying in the EU, then we have a mandate to hold a second independence referendum in Scotland, and that's what we intend to do.
So if Theresa May comes back next week and says, you know what, just forget the whole Brexit thing, would everything go back to normal? And I know that's kind of an unrealistic scenario, but do you think this whole process may have brought up bad feelings in Scotland that just won't go away that easily now?
Undoubtedly. In 2014, we nearly, those of us who wish to see an independent Scotland, we nearly won the referendum. But we didn't. And one of the main reasons we didn't was that promises were made to the people of Scotland, such as you are an equal partner in the United Kingdom. Well, that has been shown to be untrue, because although the Scots have voted to remain in the European Union, we face being taken out because the bigger country, England, overrides our vote.
You know, we've been following this Brexit story since the beginning, since 2016, and it's still arcane to a lot of us. If there is one thing you want Americans to understand about Brexit, what is it?
What Americans need to understand about Brexit is that the Brexit referendum in 2016 was won in England and Wales on the back of lies. In Scotland and Northern Ireland voted to remain, and their views have been completely overlooked by the Conservative government. And Brexit will probably lead to the breakup of the United Kingdom.
MP Joanna Cherry making the Scotland Brexit connection. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
2019 is a milestone in American history, in world history. 400 years ago, the first enslaved Africans were sold in the English colonies of the New World, the beginning of slavery, and today the U.S. is still dealing with the massive impact. The world's Roopa Shenoy visited the spot that's recognized as the place where those first enslaved Africans arrived.
It's in Virginia, on a peninsula called Point Comfort. To get to it, you have to take a bridge over a moat. On the other side is a stone wall with a narrow gap that my car just fits through.
Come on in. You've never been here before, have you?
Never.
So what did you think when you drove across the moat?
Robert Kelly's historian at Fort Monroe, the largest stone fort in America. Inside is a maze of rooms separated by stone arches. Now it's used as a museum.
The arches are a little short. They get even shorter as we go.
We arrive at a small model of what they think the first fort built here looked like. It's a cabin surrounded by cannons and a fence. The Jamestown settlers built it in 1609. There was the constant threat of attack by sea from the Spanish.
This would serve as a lookout and allow the colonists up at Jamestown, 40 miles up the river, to know, hey, somebody, you know, a potential enemy's coming into the Chesapeake Bay, and, you know, we need to prepare.
That first fort had burned down by the time a ship called the White Lion arrived carrying 20 African slaves. They were traded for food and supplies, even though there were no written laws governing slavery at the time.
John Rolfe, who was the secretary of the colony, he records this event.
John Rolfe was Pocahontas' husband. He noted the date as August 1619. We climb up to an overlook on top of the fort. An American flag snaps in the wind.
When you look out on the horizon, you can see why there's a fort here.
We're looking down at an expansive natural harbor where the Atlantic Ocean meets the Chesapeake Bay and the James River. In front of us, across the water, are three aircraft carriers and Norfolk Naval Station, the largest naval port in the world.
The 1619 state marker is actually, it's so bright you can barely see, but it's a state marker right down there along the seawall.
It's a white sign with black letters that says this is where the first enslaved Africans arrived. It went up in the 1990s. Before that, Calvin Pearson says, no one knew the real history. Pearson grew up in Hampton, the city that's home to Fort Monroe.
People ask me, why is the landing so important? And I tell them that to me, it's like your birth. You can only be born one time. Nobody can change that fact to fit their propaganda or marketing or promotion or tourism needs.
Pearson's talking about historic Jamestown, an attraction with colonial archaeological sites and reconstructed buildings. He says people thought it was the arrival site. So Pearson founded a group called Project 1619. It's been working for more than two decades to raise awareness that the first Africans arrived at Point Comfort.
We knew eventually the 400th anniversary would come. It was important to us to start this movement 25 years ago, because if we had not, the story we are telling today, the commemoration that Virginia is starting to promote, would have taken place at Jamestown.
They certainly arrived at Point Comfort. We have John Rolfe's source for that. But there's no mention in the sources that the Africans actually landed there.
James Horn is president of Jamestown Rediscovery, the foundation that runs historic Jamestown. He thinks the Africans were probably kept on the ship at Point Comfort so they wouldn't have a chance to escape. Horn says it's likely buyers rowed out to the ship to barter on board, then returned with the slaves to Jamestown. The next census shows several living there, along with Africans from the White Lion's sister ship, the Treasurer.
We have at Jamestown, without any question, a site where one of those first Africans, Angela, lived. And I think that, without taking anything away from Point Comfort or Hampton in terms of that's where the ships stopped en route, what's significant to me is we might learn more about the African experience by looking at the actual places they did live rather than simply at a place where two ships arrived.
There are a lot of archival records that no one's gone through yet. Right now, no one can say they know for sure where exactly the first enslaved Africans set foot in what today is the U.S. Wherever it was, Robert Kelly, the Fort Monroe historian, says there would be a nice poetic symmetry if it happened at Point Comfort because of the other big role this place played in history.
On the same site where slavery begins, we see it in America. We see it begin to unravel.
Kelly's talking about the Civil War. Fort Monroe stayed in the Union, even though Virginia had seceded and the fort was south of the capital of the Confederacy, Richmond, 100 miles northwest. Things were tense.
This is May of 1861.
Three enslaved men stole a boat just across the water in Confederacy-controlled country and paddled nearly 3 miles to Fort Monroe, where they asked for safe haven. It was the second day on the job for Major General Benjamin Butler. He was faced with a decision that at that point even President Lincoln had avoided making, whether the North should stand for freedom for slaves.
Butler interviews each one of the men and has to decide what to do when a representative for their owner, actually a Confederate, appears here the following day.
Butler tells the owner that since the enslaved men had been digging ditches for the Confederacy,
therefore, because they're being used against me in an act of war, I'm going to seize this property as contraband.
And with that decision, Fort Monroe became a sanctuary African Americans in the South knew they could flee to for safety. 10,000 came and set up camp. Life was far from perfect, but they built the foundation for a community that remains today. They called Fort Monroe Freedom's Fortress.
And then, you know, Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy after the Civil War, he's imprisoned here. You know, he's imprisoned in that cell right there.
Davis was held here for a year and a half. Then he was released on a $100,000 bail. He was never brought to trial. Fort Monroe continued on as an army base. In 2005, it was slated for closure until Barack Obama, urged by groups like Calvin Pearson's, designated it a national monument. Obama didn't visit then. The fort's director of communications, Phyllis Terrell, hopes he'll come this August when they open a new visitor center with a big exhibit about the Africans' arrival. Terrell's a descendant of Virginian slaves.
Well, I didn't know about the arrival here at Point Comfort. I got the bias of the arrival at Jamestown and was bought into that line.
On a hill overlooking the sign proclaiming the first African's arrival, we come upon an elegant black wrought iron arch with a name on it, a name that takes me by surprise.
Jefferson Davis Memorial Park?
Yes. You know, this was erected in the 50s by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. We had the internal conversations about, okay, what do we do with this artwork here?
They've kept it up because it's history too, Terrell says, and people can learn from it. There are plans in the works for a memorial for the first Africans, but there's much less to learn about them from written history. Their lives affected millions of people who exist today, but back then, they didn't warrant a mention. For the World, Rupa Shenoy, Fort Monroe.
The Missing Voices. Tomorrow, Rupa looks at how people today are dealing with the problematic gaps in our history.
We very rarely find any kind of artifactual item related to black people. What we have are documents that were written by white people, generally people in power.
We've got more about our reporting on the 400th anniversary of slavery in the U.S. at theworld.org. The New York museum scene. You got the Guggenheim, the Met, MoMA, the Whitney, the Noguchi Museum in Queens, and now the KGB Spy Museum. Yep, an entire museum devoted to the infamous Secret Service of the Soviet Union. Alina Simone just went there, and I'm not sure you have any reason to, Alina, but were you undercover in disguise just to even get in the mood?
No, I was in street clothes, but I have to say there was definitely a cosmic irony in seeing the KGB spy museum next to like a crawfish joint a block from the Apple store in Chelsea.
So who are the people behind this KGB spy museum?
The curators are a father and daughter duo. Julius and Agne Orbaitite.
What you can see are authentic and real. We just have...
They actually run an atomic KGB bunker museum in Lithuania. So this is a larger and more robust offshoot of their first museum. And a lot of the artifacts, they tell me that they amassed were in deep storage and are actually available for the first time here.
Did you say KGB Atomic Bunker Museum? That one is in Lithuania?
Yeah. 5 years ago, they opened a museum inside of a former atomic bunker in Kaunas, Lithuania.
So what is the connection Julius, this curator, has and his daughter to the KGB? I mean, why such a desire to open a museum around this Secret Service?
Julius doesn't describe himself or his family as, you know, people who actually suffered at the hands of the KGB. He came into this as a collector. He was a really avid collector of World War II paraphernalia, especially gas masks. And it was while he was collecting this stuff that he stumbled upon his first spy artifact, which was a telephone bugging device used by Hitler's officers to spy on his own troops. And there are only one or two in existence. And in those pre-eBay days, he realized that this was the holy grail of military collecting, this whole subterranean world of artifacts. It was so esoteric, so camouflaged as to be almost undetectable that hardly anyone was collecting them.
So what kind of exhibits are there? What do you see as you walk through this museum?
I was escorted through the museum by Julius and Agne, who describes herself as a secret telephone communications and cipher machines expert.
Wow.
Both of them were dressed in authentic KGB trenches and military coats.
And here we have actually a Stalin's lamp, a real Stalin's lamp.
There's a lot here to delight, you know, the Bond fan as well as the Kremlinologist. You know, there are these dramatically lit set pieces, a recreation of a KGB office with a safe stuffed full of Soviet-era rubles to pay off spies and cash.
Right.
There are these tiny cameras tucked into rings, signet rings.
When taking a picture with this remote controller, when you press the handle, it makes some sound, you know. So at the same moment, they had to be really professional. They had to make some sound with their throat or with the shoe to hide the sound of taking a picture.
There was this incredible tree branch that looked exactly like just something you would see fallen in the street after a storm. And on the other side of it, you walk to the other side of this glass case, and it's just catacombed with wires and listening devices. So it was sort of a mix between these dioramas and these exemplars of spy technology.
Is there anything in the museum related to Vladimir Putin, now president of Russia, but once upon a time a KGB officer himself?
There is nothing in the museum related to Putin. I think they kind of go out of their way to be non-political. But the KGB is so famous, and yet what do we really know about the KGB aside from that line in Putin's Wikipedia bio, right? I think this kind of gives us our first tactile glimpse into the KGB, its methods, its technology, not only its tiny cameras, but its manuals, its codes of conduct, things like that. And this was a culture that Vladimir Putin was steeped in.
So why open a museum like this now, Alina? Because it does seem like an interesting moment to do it.
I mean, I think we can chalk it up to America's enduring fascination with Russia, right? It kind of reminded me of Hollywood, you know? When you see this stuff up close, you just think of sort of the world's biggest and most amazing prop department with the world's highest stakes, like nuclear-level stakes.
Was it authentic enough that it made you maybe for a couple of moments even a little nervous to be around these trench-coated spy museum curators?
There is a section of the museum where they have these authentic prison doors, and instead of the cell block windows, there are these little screens that have reenactments of prison life with people wearing real prison garb. It does give you chills. I mean, this was a regime that claimed millions of lives, and even when it's presented in this, you know, somewhat kitschy context, there are real moments here that make you reflect on that.
So you were born in Ukraine. Your parents grew up in the Soviet Union. Any plans to take them to the KGB spy museum?
Yeah, I would absolutely like to walk them through. I'm really curious as to my dad's reaction. He was actually blacklisted by the KGB. They tried to recruit him as a college student, and he said no and, you know, spent a few years doing hard labor in the army and then working as a night watchman in a zoo before
right.
we were allowed to leave. So I'm really curious, like, how he would react to this inside look at their workings.
Alina Simone, always good to speak with you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
a real KGB disguise kit with grease paint and a toupee. We have some great photos from the museum at theworld.org. This here is a great band that grew up in the Soviet Union, Aquarium, or Akvarium, as they'd say there. We're diving into their more recent catalog, less grim, more bluesy, still in Russian. This is, in fact, their 2015 track, Ancient Russian Blues. Aquarium was formed by a legend in Russia, Boris Grebenshikov, who remains the only original member in the band today. They started in 1972 in St. Petersburg. At the time, it was called Leningrad. There was the KGB. And if they'd have found out there was unsanctioned rock concerts, Grebenshikov and his mates would have been in big trouble. So they played their infrequent concerts in secret and underground, taking a page, I guess, from the KGB. Huh, isn't that ironic? Leaving you with the ancient Russian blues today, we come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.